Now, in the next 60 minutes, we'll be talking to the Minister for Defence, Simon Coveney, about the assessments which the government is carrying out, and which the UN is carrying out, into the safety, purpose and role of UN forces, including our own, on the Golan Heights. We'll also be talking to Ukraine's ambassador in Ireland about the latest talk from President Putin, who now says it's time to talk about a statehood for eastern Ukraine. We'll be talking to two Irish experts who are assessing the latest volcanic eruptions in Iceland, and also talking about Canada, a country where, although things are getting better here, believe it or not, over 30 people, Irish people, a day emigrate to Canada, and we'll be hearing what kind of life awaits them there. That's all in the next 60 minutes.
It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 1st of September. This is Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1 with Cathal McCullough and Gavin Jennings.
The news headlines. Russia's foreign minister has said an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine must be the priority for key negotiations taking place today. Pakistan's national television channel has been taken off air after its headquarters in Islamabad were stormed by anti-government protesters. And former US President Jimmy Carter has called on Ireland to take a lead in introducing legislation to target buyers of sex. The news in full from Brian Jennings.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said an immediate ceasefire without conditions in Ukraine must be a priority for talks taking place today. Representatives of Russia, Ukraine, the OSCE Security Forum and separatist rebels in eastern Ukraine are due to attend the talks in the Belarusian capital Minsk. Some 2,600 people have died in eastern Ukraine since fighting began in April. The conflict broke out after Russia's annexation of Ukraine's southern Crimea Peninsula in March. Speaking ahead of the meeting, Mr. Lavrov said Ukrainian forces must pull back from positions from which they can hit civilian targets. Meanwhile, two influential American senators have urged weapons to be sent to Ukraine to help fight pro-Russian separatists. Democrat Robert Menendez, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said the Russian President Vladimir Putin must face the cost for what he called his aggression, echoing comments by Republican Senator John McCain. Earlier, Russian President Vladimir Putin called for immediate talks on statehood for eastern Ukraine to help end the conflict, as rebels continue to make gains in the country's southeast. Senator John McCain claimed, however, the time had come to arm Ukrainians fighting pro-Russian forces.
Give them the weapons they need. Give them the wherewithal they need. Give them the ability to fight. They will fight. For God's sake, can't we help these people defend themselves? This is not an incursion. This is an invasion. It's a conflict that requires our participation, not through American ground troops, but our participation, our help, and our leadership. And that is what seems to be missing.
Pakistan's national television channel has been taken off air after its headquarters in central Islamabad were stormed by anti-government protesters. PTV showed live footage of a crowd of men streaming into the building after breaking through its gates. The army has been called in to restore order. Protesters are demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif over accusations of corruption and electoral fraud, which he denies. Clashes between police and protesters in the Pakistani capital are continuing. The United States is urging Israel to reverse its decision to seize almost 400 hectares of Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank for a new Jewish settlement just south of Bethlehem. Palestinian officials have condemned the move, which is believed to be the largest land seizure by Israel in 30 years. The move paves the way for the building of further settlements, which Palestinians say are an obstacle to their formation of a future state. Israeli State Radio said the decision by the military-run local administration was in response to the killing of three Jewish teenagers in the area in June. Former US President Jimmy Carter has called on Ireland to take a lead in introducing legislation to target the buyers of sex. In letters to the Taoiseach Enda Kenny, the Minister for Justice Francis Fitzgerald and all members of the Oireachtas, Mr Carter urged politicians to act with a sense of urgency to protect prostituted women and girls. Sinead Hussey reports.
In this letter, the former US President acknowledged the progress being made in Ireland towards passing legislation that would target the buyers of sex. Mr. Carter noted the recommendations made by the Oireachtas Justice Committee last year and said he was encouraged by the cross-party support to pass such legislation. However, he said that over 12 months have passed since the recommendations were made and politicians need to act now to end what he called the exploitation, abuse and trafficking of women and girls. He said the reforms provide Ireland with an opportunity to take a lead on this important issue and inspire others to follow. He said politicians here should act to reform legislation with a sense of urgency. The Immigrant Council of Ireland has welcomed the comments and called for political leadership to bring forward legislation in this new Dáil term.
The parents of a young British boy who was removed from hospital where he is being treated for a brain tumour without doctor's consent last Thursday are due to appear in a Spanish court later today. Five-year-old Asha King and his parents were found in Malaga on Saturday following an international search. His father, Brett King, said they had taken the boy to Spain to seek a treatment that isn't currently available on the British National Health Service. Talks between unions and management in the Irish rail dispute at the Labour Relations Commission will resume at midday. The two unions, the NBRU and SIPTU, and Irish Rail Management, met over the weekend to set out their position at exploratory talks. Three more days of strike action are planned on September 7th, 8th and 21st. Now the time is coming up to 6:30 past 8.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Continental Tyres. Premium tyres as specified by the world's leading car makers, Continental Tyres.
A cloudy start with some brighter sunny spells later. A few showers are possible, but most places should be dry. Top temperatures 16 to 18 degrees.
John S. Doyle is here again with It Says in the Papers.
The Irish Examiner front page has the words capital punishment in a headline and a picture of a weeping father and son. It seems a bit severe until you realise that the punishment is only a game. And the tears of Alan and Jamie Brogan in Brendan Moran's photograph are for the defeat of the capital county Dublin by Donegal in the All-Ireland football semi-final yesterday. The photo makes an appearance in many other papers too. The Irish Times on its front page describes Donegal as giant killers. Keith Duggan writes that it may be only a matter of time before Donegal's emigrant stonemasons return to start chipping and hammering manager Jim McGuinness's likeness into the side of Mount Errigal. Donegal beat the Blues in a weekend of classics, says the Irish Independent. That paper leads on its front page with news of what it calls an historic operation to share intelligence between Ireland and Britain. Tom Brady reports that a joint watch list on suspected jihadi fighters is being operated by the authorities in both countries to prevent terrorists slipping into either jurisdiction through the back door. The Times leads with the situation in Ukraine. Daniel McLaughlin and Suzanne Lynch write that Vladimir Putin has ramped up public support for Ukraine's rebels, calling for urgent talks on statehood for regions where they are fighting, even while denying Western claims that Russia is giving the insurgents military help. The paper quotes Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko as saying in Brussels on Saturday, "We are close to the point of no return. Thousands of foreign troops and hundreds of foreign tanks are now on the territory of Ukraine. Today we are talking about the fate of Ukraine," said the president. "Tomorrow it could be all of Europe." The main story for the Irish Sun and the Irish Daily Mirror is the Irish couple Kevin Devine and John Lynch, who drowned while on holiday in Greece. Ireland must be tougher on sex offences. That's the lead headline in The Examiner, which arises out of an article in the paper by Eileen O'Malley Dunlop, head of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. She says that far too many sexual crimes are committed in this country with impunity. Her comments come as government officials flag the danger of the European Commission taking legal proceedings over Ireland's failure to implement an EU directive on sex crimes, says The Examiner. And the paper quotes the children's rights campaigner, Senator Gillian Van Turnhout, as saying she has been waiting for 3 years for the government's legislation. Also on its front page, the Examiner reports that children with arthritis are waiting more than 2 years to see a specialist. Children with obesity are the focus of the Irish Daily Mail. The paper reports on a policy paper from the Royal College of Physicians Ireland, which says foods high in fat, salt and sugar should not be advertised on television before 9 p.m. and they should never be advertised to children. The Independent says a Dublin doctor has claimed that children as young as 7 are being targeted by Coca-Cola's Share a Coke campaign. The campaign, which features popular names on the drink's bottle, is a form of advertising to children by stealth, according to Professor Donal O'Shea. Almost all of the 100 most popular names of 7 or 8-year-olds are included in their campaign, he said. And on the first day of autumn, children in the classroom feature in The Independent. The paper says that 125,000 pupils will spend this year in classes of 30 or more. According to the Irish National Teachers Organisation, this makes our primary school classrooms the most overcrowded in Europe. The Irish Daily Star reports in its lead story on the shooting in a Dublin pub on Saturday night. The paper says that 2 innocent men were shot at Oil Can Henry's in Lower Mount Street in front of shocked US tourists in town for an American football game. As for the 2 F-16 fighter jets that flew low over Croke Park for the football game, the Times says the roar of their engines drew complaints from disturbed Dublin residents. The boom caused car alarms to go off, dogs to howl and people to run from their homes. And there was a complaint from the anti-war group AFRI. A spokesman for the organisation asked who gave consent for what he called this invasion of Irish airspace by elements of the US war machine.
John, thank you.
We go next to the Middle East, or to events concerning the Middle East, because Irish and other troops involved in the United Nations Observer Mission on the Golan Heights have been involved in several tense situations over the past couple of days. Shots have been fired. There have been no injuries, and we're told that Irish soldiers are all safe and well. But the whole situation is leading both the government and the United Nations to reassess what exactly those troops are doing there, the mandate under which they operate, and whether that mission should indeed continue shortly. Irish troops are to be rotated with new soldiers from Ireland going out to join the mission. There are about 130 troops there at the moment. I rang the Minister for Defence and Agriculture, Simon Coveney, earlier this morning to get his assessment of the latest situation.
Well, first of all, clearly the last 3 days has been a period of significant tension. Essentially what has happened is that Ireland is involved in a UN mission to maintain what's called a demilitarized zone between Syria and Israel. That's been there since 1974. And the purpose of it is essentially to create a peaceful buffer strip, if you like, between two countries that in the past have been at war. And it's been a very successful mission. Unfortunately, in recent weeks, and in particular in recent days, that demilitarized zone has been dragged into a very nasty civil war in Syria that people read about and see on the television each week. And as part of that, UN posts have been attacked by Syrian rebels. There are currently 43 Fijian soldiers that are still captured and detained by those rebels, and there's an ongoing negotiation to try and secure their safe release. 2 other UN posts that were that had Filipino troops in them, both had approximately 40 troops, were 48 hours ago surrounded by rebel militia, essentially. I'm very glad to say that the Irish contingent is part of that UN force, who are a mobile, well-armed contingent who get called in when there are flashpoints or difficult situations to handle. They went into one of those posts to secure their Filipino colleagues, and they successfully did that and got out again without any loss of life or injury. They did take fire on the way in and returned fire, but successfully completed that mission, and I think people should be very proud of the professionalism and courage of the Irish Defence Forces over the last few days.
Now, the assessment which is going to be carried out, and which I gather is going to be carried out in a United Nations context, of the role that this force and our troops in this UN force is playing. How long is that going to take? Who will be involved?
Okay, well, there's a number of reviews already underway, and I've made it very clear that I'm not going to continue to commit Irish troops to this mission unless there's a very fundamental review of how it's going to operate, because clearly this is no longer a demilitarized zone. We need to get assurances from the UN and indeed, where possible, from Israel and Syria that we can operate to the mandate of this mission. Don't forget that these UN troops are relatively lightly armed. This is really about maintaining and patrolling an area that is and has been largely peaceful, as opposed to a war zone, which is what is happening now. There are two reviews going on. One review is already underway, actually on the ground in the Golan Heights, by the commanding officer there, who's an Indian officer, and our lead officer from Ireland is very much involved in that. And then, of course, there needs to be a broader review in New York, in UN headquarters, as to how they intend to take this mission forward, if they intend to take this mission forward, because the current mandate is simply not matched to the current conditions on the ground. Everyone knows that when you send peacekeepers to a part of the world like the Middle East, there is always risk. But certainly what has happened over the last 3 days is not an acceptable level of risk from my perspective, and I suspect the government's perspective either.
When will will these reviews be complete, and when will the government make a decision about our UN troops' continued involvement in this particular mission?
Well, we're due to have a what's called a new rotation, whereby we would replace most of the troops there with new troops who have been trained up for this mission in Ireland. That's due to take place in the next month or so. And clearly, we will need to have a review before then, before we make those decisions. So this review needs to happen quickly. But don't forget, our primary focus for the moment, today, and if necessary, for the next number of days, is to do everything we can as part of that mission to secure the release of our Fijian colleagues. Because this incident that has happened and is very unwelcome over the last number of days is not over yet. Certainly, the Irish troops are safe and all accounted for. The Filipino troops that were under threat are also now safe, but we do have 43 soldiers that are effectively captured and kidnapped.
Well, exactly. What can happen? What can any country? The Fijians, obviously, it's their greatest concern, but directly or very closely, and it concerns us as well. These troops are being held by this Al-Nusra Front, as it's known, in a situation where you can't ring a government and say, let these people go, because they're not being held by any government forces. And of course, we know what's happening, the civil war in Syria. What can be done to try and bring about those soldiers' release?
Well, first of all, it's quite difficult because, people are talking about the Al-Nusra Front, which is essentially a Syrian offshoot of Al-Qaeda. But actually, these groups are quite disparate. You find that at different times there are different people leading those groups. So, for example, there has been a lot of negotiation to try and defuse a very, very tense situation two nights ago, where one of the UN posts was surrounded by nearly 300 very heavily armed opposition troops in Syria. But they were actually made up of different regional leaders, if you like. So it's quite difficult to know who you're actually negotiating with. But this isn't new to the UN. There have been two incidents over the last year or so where soldiers have been detained or captured, and their release has been secured on both occasions through negotiation. So my understanding is that those negotiations have been going on now for some time, and they're continuing into today. But they're difficult negotiations. But there are trained negotiators who are doing that as we speak. But you're right. You're not negotiating with the government here. You're essentially negotiating with a local or regional warlord or tribal leader.
Does that mean, effectively, there's nothing you or the Minister for Foreign Affairs can do? It's up to the UN representatives on the ground and officers on the ground?
Well, I mean, what we can do is we can put a lot of pressure on the UN, which we have been doing. I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise to people that I've spent a lot of time on the phone, both to our ambassador in the UN, who's done a great job over the last few days, but also to others who are linked to what has been happening.
Is it likely or possible that the rotation, which is due to begin shortly, will be delayed while the government assesses the situation and waits the results of these reviews you've told us about?
Well, of course that's possible. I mean, you know, I'm not going to rush a decision here. I mean, if the Irish decide to pull out of this UNDOF mission, in my view, the mission will collapse. So I'm not going to make that decision lightly, but I'm certainly also not going to accept the status quo either. We need to get significant reassurance from the UN, and if possible from the Israeli and Syrian side, but this is really about the Syrian side, not the Israeli side, that we can operate a UN mission in relative safety. There are unacceptable levels of risk, if you like, attached to missions like this, and certainly at the moment, the risk levels, given what's happened over the last 3 days, are not acceptable.
In that situation, which, as you say, is being assessed and which is obviously unstable, what can you say right now about the safety and the training and the equipment of our soldiers there and the position they find themselves in?
Well, first of all, can I say, I mean, my first priority is the safety of our troops, and they are very well trained. They are the best equipped troops in that UN mission by far. That is why they are in the mobile unit and get called in for very difficult operations. And I can tell you, the way in which they have performed in the last 3 days not only has ensured their own safety, but they have also assisted considerably in ensuring the safety of their colleagues as well.
A final question, Minister, about something that has happened not far away in another troubled area, that is the occupied territories, the West Bank, and a major settlement announced by Israel. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, in the face of it, my response to that would be that this is not helpful. I think everybody in that region should be trying to provide some stability and focus on a lasting peace settlement, given what's happened in a very tragic way in Gaza over the last number of weeks. So the announcement of a big new settlement in the West Bank sounds to me to be very unhelpful in that regard, and will only inflame further tensions in the West Bank and in Gaza. But really, it's the first I've read of it this morning, so I don't want to comment beyond that.
And that's the Minister for Agriculture and Defence, Simon Coveney, speaking to me earlier this morning.
Ukraine next, where Russian President Vladimir Putin wants to talk about statehood for the east of the country. Earlier, the Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko said, "I think we're very close to the point of no return. Point of no return is full-scale war. In the coastal city of Mariupol, people are leaving and Ukrainian forces are digging trenches waiting for another Russian assault." The Ukrainian ambassador to Ireland is Sergei Reva, and he's here. Ambassador, thank you very much for coming into us this morning. Full-scale war, what does your president mean by that, do you think?
The situation in Ukraine has aggravated and entered a qualitatively new dimension. I would say a very dangerous dimension. Because before, as you know, Russia inspired, supplied so-called rebels, pro-Russian separatists in Donetsk and Lugansk region, sent sophisticated armament and everything. But now they passed to direct invasion, military invasion. So Russian troops are there. Thousands of Russian militaries with armed vehicles, tanks, are on our territory. And of course, that is a real risk of full-scale war.
Could Ukraine really take on Russia in such a war? Could it win such a war?
It's a difficult question. Of course, we are outnumbered and there is no comparison between our military powers. But for us, it would be a war, a patriotic war. It's a war for our motherland. Russians are occupants. They have nothing to do on our territory. So I think the spirit of nation is very strong.
President Putin wants talks, he says, about statehood for eastern Ukraine. Is there enough will in Ukraine to prevent that happening?
Well, I think that is nothing new in this proposal. It's the same tactics Russia pursued in previous occasions in Georgia, in Moldova, to create quasi-states or zone of instability to influence the internal and foreign policy of a country. The idea of creating Novorossiya, which means New Russia, it's quite eloquent, the notion itself.
You mentioned about Georgia, where the region of Abkhazia is not a separate country, it's not a separate state, it's kind of like a semi-Russian region within Georgia. It leaves Georgia destabilized to some extent, and having done that as a model in Georgia, it seems that that's what Russia is intent on doing in Ukraine as well.
I have the same feeling.
With what consequences?
Consequences are very clear. As I already said, the idea is to influence, to press Ukrainian government. The main idea is very clear. It's to prevent us from approaching and joining in the future maybe the European Union, NATO, and so on, not to have an independent foreign policy and to be in the orbit of Russia.
What do you want? What does Ukraine want from NATO and the EU?
Our president was quite clear at the last EU summit in Brussels, saying that we need actually two type of actions. First, military and technical support. Of course, he said quite clearly that we don't expect European countries' soldiers to fight and battlefield on the territory of Ukraine. Of course not. But we need technical and military support.
Weapons?
He said that not lethal weapons, like helmets, communications, tools and so on. And on the other hand, I think that due to gravity of the situation in Ukraine, there are more substantive and effective sanctions are needed.
More substantial and effective sanctions. By that, can I imply that you believe the current sanctions, particularly from the EU, aren't working?
You can see yourself after, you see what we witnessed, first occupation and then annexation of Crimea, supplying separatists, pro-Russian separatists with sophisticated weaponry, which permitted them to shoot down civil aircraft. Now, military invasion. What else is needed to understand that sanctions are not working?
But sanctions will hurt EU countries. That's presumably why they don't want to impose even heavier ones.
Because these sanctions are not working, as you rightly said, as you rightly hinted. Sanctions, first of all, are to be effective. Are to prevent, at least to be as much effective as to stop the aggressor from continuing its aggressive policy.
Sergei Reva, Ukrainian ambassador to Ireland, thank you very much for coming into our studio this morning. Darren Frehel is back with the sports news and reflections on, well, if you weren't a Gaelic football fan before Saturday and Sunday, you should be now.
What a weekend, Gavin. What can we say about the weekend that we just had in the GAA Championship? Donegal will meet Kerry in the 2014 All-Ireland Football Final. Donegal beat Dublin 3-14 to 17 points in Croke Park. And a 20-year-old, the star of the show, young Ryan McHugh, inspired his side to victory, scoring 2-2. Kerry booked their place in the decider with a 3-16 to 3-13 win against Mayo on Saturday evening. It was a weekend of action that will live long in the memory.
He's got another one, and Donegal, another goal. O'Donoghue for Kerry. Sent the goalkeeper the wrong way, into the back of the net. Wonderful penalty from James O'Donoghue. Level for the second time. Could we be going all the way? Could we have 20?
Comes as another goal chance, and there is another goal, and it's Callum McFadden this time. That is quite amazing.
Another penalty, James O'Donoghue, and he sent the goalkeeper the wrong way again, but he put it the other side. Stunner of a penalty from James O'Donoghue. It's the game and the fixture that just keeps on giving.
An amazing story at Croke Park this afternoon, an amazing weekend of football as well.
Well, it certainly worked out at the weekend for Donegal and for Kerry. I'm joined on the line now by Paul Early. Paul, let's start with yesterday. We were told they were in decline. I don't think we've ever seen as big an outsider as we've seen Donegal yesterday in the semi-final. How did they upset the odds against Dublin?
Well, I think, you know, listening to Jim McGuinness before the game, he talked about the Donegal focus was on delivering a performance worthy of the occasion. And I think it was one of his great coaching achievements and one of the great coaching achievements that I've ever seen to prepare a team as he did, you know, to produce the type of performance really against all the odds. And I think they coped with Dublin early on, even though Dublin had the chance, obviously, to go 7 or 8 points ahead. And I think the second goal chance, which was saved by Paul Durkin, was a crucial turning point in the game. And I think once they weathered that storm, and Michael Murphy, I think, summed it up so well in the post-match interview, he said, we weathered the storm and we kept true to ourselves, stuck with the game plan and had total trust and confidence in themselves and their management to carry out that game plan. And I think that was the key part of the game, that after Dublin had kicked some outrageous points, you know, Paul Flynn and Jim O'Connolly given an absolutely phenomenal display of long-range kicking, but you won't do that for the whole of the game. Once Donegal got a grip, I thought Christy Toy's introduction was very significant, and their key players then got on the ball and started to influence the game. And once they went ahead, as we've seen in the past, they are almost impossible to pull back. And Dublin, in the end, just ran out of ideas in their forward line. An experienced enough forward line, they just needed to get goals, but Donegal just shut up shop in the centre of the defence and produce some tremendous skillful football as well, you'd have to say. Mm. People talk about Donegal as being just a defensive team, but the quality and the skill that they displayed yesterday was of the highest standard. And that applied to all four teams who played over the weekend.
Eugene McGee described in today's paper, The Independent, as Saturday evening's match as a game for the ages. What was the difference between Mayo and Kerry on Saturday?
Well, I think there was a couple of differences. I think, you know, I thought we saw one of the great individual displays in recent years in David Moran's colossal performance at midfield for Kerry. And I think you win midfield and you win it comprehensively as Kerry did, you're going to be very hard to beat. And, you know, he was my man of the match by a country mile on Saturday. He was just outstanding. And, of course, then we saw the re-emergence of what we thought was that extinct animal, the tall full forward who can win his own ball, in Kieran Donaghy, who really terrorised the Mayo defence throughout the game with his ball-winning ability and unselfish passing. And the difficulty is, in the modern game, defenders are no longer used to dealing with the direct high ball because it's used so little. The game is about possession. There's a lot of short passing, a lot of balls kicked in front of forwards. And that means there are very few tall, combative defenders who can compete in the air and break ball on a player like Kieran Donaghy. So I think while Mayo went 7 points ahead in the first half, that was really against the run of play because Kerry had that dominance in the middle of the field, and eventually it wore them down because every time the ball went in, it looked as if Kerry could score a goal. But you have to say as well, Mayo were very unlucky because, you know, they did lose a 5-point lead in the draw game. They lost Aidan O'Shea and Killian O'Connor due to the accidental clash of heads, which did have an impact. And I think they were very unlucky in that some of the very big calls went against them. Mm. The reality is that Kerry should have been down to 14 men early on, a clear black card not given, and there were serious question marks about certainly the first penalty that Kerry got and a few frees in the first period of injury time. So, you know, a combination, although I thought Kerry were the better team overall, I think that the Donaghy factor was a huge one.
Finally, Paul, and briefly, if you don't mind, it's a unique pairing. These two have never met in an All-Ireland final before. They did meet in the quarter-final in 2012, which was won by Donegal. Who are your favourites on the 21st of September?
Well, after yesterday, I'm giving up predictions, Darren, because we saw what happened with Donegal. But just thinking about it, I think maybe marginally Donegal, because again, when you look at the difficulty the Dublin forwards had, the experienced Dublin forward line, who had won a couple of All-Irelands, had in breaking down the Donegal defence yesterday. Kerry are a younger team, more inexperienced players. You know, it would be a real challenge for them, I think, to open up that Donegal defence. Having said that, you have the Donaghy factor, as I said, which will cause Donegal some problems. So I'd go marginally for Donegal at this stage, but very marginally.
Okay, we're looking forward to that final in just under 3 weeks' time. Paul Early, thanks for taking the call this morning. Donegal qualified for the first ever minor decider as well. They beat Dublin 112 to 111. In rugby, big news coming from France. The Irish Examiner is reporting that Jonathan Sexton has been ruled out of action for at least 2 months with a broken jaw. The Irish out-half suffered the injury playing for his club Racing Metro over the weekend. It's hoped he will be fit for the November internationals. In the Premier League yesterday, Liverpool beat Tottenham 3-0. Arsenal finished 1-1 away to Leicester. Aston Villa beat Hull City 2-1. In the SPL, Celtic drew 1-1 away to Dundee. Graham McDowell secured his place in the European Ryder Cup team. Stephen Gallagher needed to finish inside the top two at the Italian Open yesterday to overtake him in the rankings, but he had to settle for third place, so it's McDowell who has guaranteed his ticket. Paul McGinley will announce his captain's picks tomorrow. The final round of the Deutsche Bank Championship will be completed today. Russell Henley leads on 12 under. Rory McIlroy right on the hunt on 10 under par. Good news for the Irish equestrian team. They qualified for the Rio Olympics yesterday. Sunita Puspor finished in fourth place in the single sculls event at the World Rowing Championships. Owen Clifford claimed his second world title of the weekend at the UCI Paracycling Road World Championships in America. Dan Martin is up to 15th at the Vuelta España. Also a good day for Donegal in motorsport. Declan Boyle won the Galway Summer Rally in a Subaru, the sixth round of the Dunlop National Rally Championship. Jockey David Condon is in a stable condition following a heavy fall at Cork. And finally, today's racing is in Roscommon. The action gets underway at 4:45.
Darren, thank you. Latest figures suggest that some 14,000 Irish people are expected to move to Canada this year. There are currently 50,000 Irish-born people living and working there, and a further 4.5 million claim Irish heritage. Attracted by a booming economy and an unemployment rate currently half of what it is here, Irish people have set up home right across the 10 provinces of Canada. In the first part of a special series on the Irish emigrating to Canada, our Washington correspondent Katrina Perry has this report.
Just have a look at it on the map. Hamilton, Ontario.
For one family in Kildare, their new home is just a place on a map right now.
Oh, that's a nice one. Do you like that one, Ava?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
oh, what do you think of that?
That's a nice
one. Is that in Canada?
Yeah.
It is.
Darren Gavin, fiancé Amy Rye, sent their two children, 3-year-old Reese and 5-year-old Ava, are packing up and emigrating to Canada. Laid off from his banking job earlier this year, Darren struggled to find another position.
I'd applied for 180, 200 jobs, and I've 15 years banking experience. I had applied for lots of different roles, and I couldn't get a look. And if I did, it was going for 50% of the salary that I was on. So for me, Canada offered me a different opportunity.
He has extended family in Hamilton, a city just south of Toronto with a reasonably sized Irish population. The Irish Canadian Club in Hamilton was set up more than 50 years ago to help new immigrants. But nevertheless, moving will still be hard, as Amy explains.
Very, very difficult. You know, I'm a real home bird. I have a very, very close family. My sister actually passed away 5 years ago, and since then we've been even a closer family. And then with the two kids arriving, it's, you know, up to nannies and up to grandmas the whole time, you know, any day that they want. And grandma actually minds them when I'm at work. Plus, my mom doesn't fly on airplanes, so I won't see her until we come home. But I am looking forward to it. And it's taken me, I think it took for me to say, okay, do you know what, we're going, for then to kind of went, right, okay, let's look at the positives of it, because I kept focusing on the negatives and I'm not going to see anyone, I'm not going to have anyone around. And but no, I'm going to look at the positives now, you know, and it is a fantastic opportunity, especially for Darren in his career.
So go over and get that teddy over there, please.
Which one?
a teddy there, yeah.
Aside from Darren's struggles to get a job in Ireland, the couple are focused on their children, feeling that their future in Canada will be better than the one on offer in Ireland.
It's always about your kids making sure they're successful. Yeah. And I think there's an opportunity for them too as well. I'd love them to have experienced it. I think travelling abroad and living abroad does make people more rounded and more accepting.
Over there, there's so much that can be done. Mm. And Reese just keeps saying, I want to play ice hockey. He's only three. I don't think he even knows what ice hockey is. But, you know, I'll enjoy introducing them to new things, you know, because Ireland's as great and as much as I love it, it is very closed, you know, and Canada is so broad and so open. And there's so many new things for the kids, you know, to experience over there. So
that's one of the main reasons we're doing it, because the kids have so much opportunity.
And as for last minute worries,
my children, obviously, you know, and I actually think that it's more me, you know, letting go of family, but I just hope that they're not upset about it and that it doesn't throw them too much. Failing over there isn't a fear for me, because we can always come home.
Yeah. It's an opportunity, but yeah, we are both a little bit anxious about it, I think, yeah. Aren't we? A bit apprehensive, but sure.
It's a few weeks later and Darren has arrived in Hamilton. Amy and the kids will follow later. They're just one family out of an expected 14,000 Irish people who'll make the move to Canada this year.
It was tough at the airport, yeah, to say goodbye to everybody. But I just kept telling myself it was like I was going on a 3 or 4 week holiday, because I was seeing the kids in 3 weeks. I was quite upset for the whole part of the queue, to be honest.
And as for the main reason for moving, how was the first day in the new job?
Everyone was great, and I thought I'd have to explain myself a little bit more with my accent and stuff like that, but it seemed fine, so yeah, and it worked out. Got a lift off someone home and made friends.
That's Darren Gavin from Kildare, now living in Hamilton, ending that report from our Washington correspondent, Katrina Perry. You can see more from Darren and his family on the 6-1 News tonight on RTE One Television, and hear the second part of that series tomorrow morning here on Morning Ireland.
Two scientists from UCD are involved in a volcano research project. One of them, geophysics professor Chris Bean, told me what they're trying to find out, along with Iceland's Met Service and the Geological Survey of Ireland. He was close by the Bárðarbunga volcano in Iceland yesterday during its latest relatively mild eruption. And he told me earlier what it was like.
It was a fissure eruption, as it's called. That's not a very explosive event. It's an event where you have a very, very large crack in the ground and it opens and you get curtains of lava or lava fountains spewing out. It looks very, very exotic and it looks very, very exciting. You can get reasonably close to those eruptions because they're not explosive, and then the lava flows out across the Earth's surface, but it doesn't go very, very high into the air. So, for example, in the first 2 hours of the eruption yesterday morning, the fissure itself was a kilometer long and the lava on the surface had spread about 3 kilometers. So it moves fairly quickly and is obviously extremely hot as it comes out, and you know, takes many, many months to cool down completely.
The Icelandic authorities have restricted aviation in the immediate area of the volcano. Otherwise, has it had any noticeable impact on life there?
Yeah, you're right. There have been restrictions, but the whole area is cordoned off. There are several things that may happen, and that's what the concern is. There's a very large glacier, Vatnajökull glacier, and Bárðarbunga volcano is sitting underneath that glacier. And if the volcano erupts into the bottom of the glacier, water will get into the system, and we could have a very explosive eruption, just like we did with Eyjafjallajökull back in 2010. So that's one concern. The other thing that's happening at the moment is just north of the glacier, that's where the fissure has come out, and that's where that exotic eruption we talked about yesterday occurred. But if that continues to go further north, there's another volcano north of that called Askja. And if that fissure connects into Askja, things could become very uncertain. So there's a lot of multitude of different things going on at the same time, which has, you know, brings some uncertainty into the picture, and therefore the whole area is cordoned off for tourists and so on.
Just a word about aviation, because the airlines and the aviation authorities are telling us that their equipment and their monitoring systems and their testing have changed since that eruption a few years ago, which caused so much disruption to flights around the world, certainly in that part of in that part of Northern Europe. What do you think is the likelihood or possibility of Bardar Bunga causing problems of that we would notice in the air?
Yeah, well, one of the things from a volcanological point of view that's important is the size of the particles, you know, the ash. The ash is actually pulverized rock. So in a highly explosive system where you get water interacting with the magma, you can get the rock pulverized into very, very small particles. And if they're of the wrong size, for want of a better expression, they can interfere with the jet engine. So it's really about the size of those particles. So the whole thing starts with the nature of the eruption. If the eruption is highly explosive and fragments the rock into very small particles, then that can be the problem. Of course, once the material comes into the atmosphere, then it's really down to the meteorological situation. Wind direction, and also, of course, how the plume goes will determine how far that material can travel. So it really all starts at source with the volcano itself.
That's Professor Chris Bean from UCD speaking to me earlier this morning from Iceland.
Girls in all secondary schools here will be offered a vaccine this month to protect against the causes of cervical cancer. 85% of first-year students took the vaccine last year in three doses. It's been changed to two doses now. Dr. Brenda Corcoran is here to tell us more. She's a consultant in public health medicine and a representative of the HSE National Immunisation Office. Dr. Corcoran, thank you for coming in to us. It's been running for 3 years now, and the uptake has been very high.
The uptake has been very high, and we're very pleased to see that this year 42,000 girls completed the three-dose course of the vaccine, and we now know that they are protected against the types of HPV which cause 7 out of 10 cases of cervical cancer. So it's very good news.
This is human papillomavirus. It's a common virus. Most women will get it at some stage, but some of those viruses can cause cervical cancer.
Yes, and we don't know which girls will go on to develop the cancer. So that's why it's important that all girls get the vaccine before they start any possible exposure to the virus. That's why the vaccine is given to 12-year-old girls. We know the vaccine works better in younger girls than in older girls.
And yet, if you miss out on it at 12 or 13, you can take it in later years.
You can, but the expert group here and in all other countries have recommended the best time to get it is around the age of 12.
Are you surprised at the high uptake, given that there was some reservation on the part of some parents at giving this vaccine to 11, 12-year-old, 13-year-old children, because they're unlikely to be sexually active at that age?
That's true, but the vaccine is to protect against cancer, and I think parents have read all the information that has been out there. They've listened to all the experts that have been talking, and they now realise that this is an important vaccine to get for their daughters. It does protect against cancer. We know that it's been widely used since 2007 in Australia and in Denmark, and already they've seen a 50% reduction in precancers, which are required to develop cancer. So the vaccine is working, and the evidence for the vaccine to work is there. Parents believe this, and they're getting the vaccine for their daughters.
Is it fair to say that it's too early to see any similar results here?
We only started in 2010, so it will be a little while longer before we see some of the evidence. But we would be very hopeful that we would be seeing some results very soon.
Three doses to two. Why?
Because, again, there is new evidence to say that two doses are as effective as three doses in young girls, which, again, is good news for the girls and for their parents.
Is this vaccine given at school or at your GP?
The vaccine is given in school as part of the school immunisation programme. There are three vaccines that are given to first years. The HPV vaccine is given to girls, and two other vaccines will be given to both boys and girls in first year as part of the school programme.
There's a new vaccine. There's one for another one to protect against meningitis.
This is a vaccine, the MEN-C vaccine, meningococcal C vaccine, which causes meningitis and septicemia, or blood poisoning. We know that there are two peaks in the numbers of cases, mostly in young children under 5 years of age. But again, there's another peak at 15 to 19 years of age. The vaccine is currently routinely given to all babies since the year 2000, and we've seen a huge reduction in cases. But there are concerns that this immunity, the protection that babies have, may wane or may reduce over time, so that when they become young adults, they may develop the disease again, which is why our expert group have recommended a booster in first year in school.
Brenda, thank you very much. That's Dr. Brenda Corcoran from the HSC's National Immunisation Office.
It's not every day that the Taoiseach gets a letter from a former US president, but former President Jimmy Carter has written a letter to Enda Kenny and indeed to every member of the Oireachtas about our laws on prostitution. Our reporter Sinead Hussey can tell us more. First of all, what is President Carter saying to them in this letter?
Well, this letter is quite short. It's three paragraphs long, but in that letter he really does get his point across and exactly how Ireland should progress its laws on prostitution. Basically what he's saying is what we've done so far is good, in that the Justice Committee last year made recommendations where it would target the buyers of sex as opposed to the actual prostitutes. But what he's saying now is the time for action. 12 months has passed since those recommendations were made and there's been no action from politicians. And he's saying that we need to take a lead on this and inspire other countries to follow suit. And he's saying that with a sense of urgency, politicians must take this bill on now and bring in this legislation.
Yeah, criminalising the buying of sex has been made illegal in the Scandinavian countries, I think, and only in those countries so far. And he's effectively saying to them, get a move on. All your politicians on this Justice Committee are agreed. Time to do it.
Absolutely. He's saying that, you know, Ireland needs to take a lead on this. We've obviously have a cross-party support. The Justice Committee, it was a unanimous recommendation that we would go down this route. And he's saying now, looking ahead into this new Dáil term, it's time to do that.
Do we know how this letter came about?
The Immigrant Council of Ireland are one of the organisations behind this campaign and have been leading it for quite a while. They made representations to the President, I understand, last May, and his office made contact in July. The President was interested in this. It's an area he's very interested in. He's written a book not so long ago about abuses of women worldwide, not just sex trafficking and not just this particular abuse, but all sorts of abuses against women around the world. So he took an interest in it and decided that he would write directly to the Taoiseach, directly to the Justice Minister, and then send an open letter to all TDs and senators.
Well, it's very brief and to the point. Prostitution is inherently violent, he says, towards women and girls, and I support efforts to help those who are trapped in this industry. I hope that you will lead your nation towards the protection of prostitute women and girls with a sense of urgency. Sinead Hussey, thank you very much.